The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And my guest today is sommelier from wineonline.ca, also has his own consulting company, Sam Fritz Tate. Sam, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to chat all things wine.
Yeah. So first, just tell the listeners, I don't know, if audience listeners, whichever one, just your role, what you do with Wine Online.
Cool. So yeah, Wine Online is a super exciting company. I'm the Senior Vice President of Sales. Basically what that means is that I do a lot of our sales pitch. I do all of our restaurant work, so I taste with a lot of restaurants. But I'm also, and the thing I'm most excited about is that I get to work directly with consumers. I get to help them to make decisions on everything from what to buy to what events to go to. And I also host all of our events. We do a series of wine dinners, everything ranging from Grand Cru Burgundy dinners all the way to really interesting value approach tastings.
And you got one of those tonight. Like we're at the Vintage Conservatory on Lombard, and there's an event tonight, isn't there?
Yeah, there is an event tonight. I can't take credit for this one, but I can take credit for the group of people that is assembled here. I've always believed that wine should be tasted with some kind of ability to understand it with context. And I think that doing dinners where you get to teach people and people get to experience the wine side by side gives you a real impression of a region, a vintage, a producer, or even more broadly, a country.
Yeah. And what's the event tonight?
The event tonight is a wine club, and it's all things Pinot, but essentially, having looked at the lineup of wines, it is all things Grand Cru Burgundy.
Yeah, there's a bit of a range there from all things Pinot to all things Grand Cru Burgundy. Let's go there. Like I've got a whole bunch of questions, but why is it Grand Cru Burgundy? Why is it? I mean, it's basically the most expensive. I mean, it's more expensive than Bordeaux. I think it's a fairly, you know, safe assertion to say the most expensive wines in the world is Grand Cru Burgundy.
They're certainly out there. I mean, the stratospheric wines certainly exist in Bordeaux still, but certainly the most expensive wines on current release today are some of, if not the most expensive wines in the world. What is interesting to understand about Burgundy is that phenomenon is only about 10 years old. For a long time, these wines were not stratospherically expensive. Granted, they were still hundreds of dollars upon release, but they weren't thousands. Why Grand Cru Burgundy? When Burgundy is at its best, it is truly one of the great world's greatest wines. I happen to think that Northern Rhone Syrah often surpasses it, but I think that something about Pinot Noir that is so interesting, so enthralling, it has this ability to seduce you and excite you at the same time as giving you deep pleasure, and it continues to change and evolve, and all of that while being less than 14% alcohol and being full of freshness.
Yeah, that's a good point about the alcohol levels. You can, you know, sometimes drink a big, powerful wine, but if the alcohol's 15 and it's, you know, 14 and a half or 15 or higher, it can just, you know, after a glass, you're like, okay, I've kind of, even though it's delicious, I've had enough of it. You're right about the Burgundy; it's different, and that's something that it's been consistent with this podcast. Is what people are looking for is freshness in their red wine.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you bring up some really good points. I think at the end of the day, we all want to have an enjoyable experience with wine, and great wine generally should be paired with food. And I think for wine to be paired with food, it needs that freshness, it needs that acid so that you can continue to want. I always say that the true sign of the world's greatest wines is something that you want another glass of.
Yeah.
If you get tired after having one glass of it, no matter how expensive, no matter how many Parker points, it's not one of the world's greatest wines. We love to drink. At the end of the day, wine is about enjoyment and drinking it. And if you can only drink one glass, it doesn't cut it for me.
You know, it's funny. That was almost the exact same answer that Will Pretum gave ages ago on this podcast. And we'll talk about. I brought a wine to drink, a 2011 Bandol from Domaine Tempier, and you gave a little. Is this from you guys, the Alberino that we were drinking?
Yeah, it certainly is. We work with a really incredible small producer for Alberino. Northern Spain, right in the Salnés Valley. Crisp, delicious. I always love, no matter if you're going to drink red wine all evening, to start with either some kind of sparkling wine or with white. It wakes up the palate, and in the end makes all the red wines you have throughout the evening so much better.
Let that be a tip. If it's going to be a long night with drinking, start with a little bit of crisp white wine, some acidity. It helps. Actually, what I appreciate about this is with a lot of just bad or generic Albarino, it's pretty light, you know, and it's just this very simple, crisp, almost alcohol delivery system, so kind of like a slightly better version than generic Pinot Grigio. But this, the mid-palate, like there's a little bit more body to this, and there's a little bit more like orange sweetness going on. I mean, not that sweet wine, but just like orange power on this wine that I'm enjoying.
Absolutely. I think the hallmark for great Albarino is going to be that orange fruit, orange citrus characteristic, and orange flowers too, that really give it that extra dimension of...
How'd you get started at wineonline.ca? By the way, do you like the plugin? I'm not just saying wine online, the full website.
Yeah, absolutely. I got started at Wine Online I met the founder of Wine Online, who tragically passed away last year, but 4 years ago, Aaron Bick. He was a visionary, having started selling wine online in Ontario 15 years ago when even the LCBO thought it was illegal, even though now we can quite rightly prove that it is not. They had a portfolio that was wide-ranging, but they had some of what I thought were the greatest producers in the world, and they were not selling to restaurants. They were not getting their name out there, despite being in a massive, massive business at the time. I thought there was a lot of room for growth. I thought the family that was running it were truly great people, and I think that's one thing we can always say about the wine industry is that while no one will ever make an absolute fortune, wine is always made by beautiful places. It's always sold by beautiful people and made by beautiful people. And I really clicked with them. And so I was a buyer at a restaurant at the time. I left to work for another small agency. And then Aaron decided to offer me a position to expand our business into events, into restaurants, into, you know, adding that next level. And I can only say that it's been the most exciting year in the wine business for me, has been doing this job.
That's fantastic. That's great. And you're right. It's, people always think wine, oh, you fancy rich people. I'm like, nope, you will not. It's not where to go to get rich, but you'll be, and this sounds so cheesy, rich with experience. You know, whether you're traveling, I believe you're in Piemonte, or, you know, just get to meet cool winemakers and things like that. Is it fair to say that if the LCBO was a much more open organization that embraced the idea of helping Canadians get wine from all over the world, that wineonline.ca might not be as successful or as important if the LCBO, especially back when they started in 04, if the LCBO was welcoming to that idea?
I think if the LCBO listened to consumers more and understood the market more, then we would be less successful. I still think that there will always be a model for something that it doesn't come from the monopoly. But I do believe that, I mean, the LCBO only started selling wine online last year.
Yeah. Right?
And they haven't been incredibly successful. They're looking at an e-commerce company, and I won't get too technical, but I think that one thing we have always prided ourselves on since the beginning is customer service. And that's something that the monopoly has yet to be able to truly figure out. We offer free returns, free delivery. We offer a great deal of customer service in terms of what you should buy, when you should buy.
Six packs, single bottles when you can, if you can. I know that one's always hard. And you guys do a really good job just in terms of the information for the wine. Like you make it easier for people that might be nervous buying wine, you know. I don't want to keep saying online. I want to kind of find other ways, because I'm saying the same way, but what other way is there? Via the internet, you make it easier for people that might be insecure about it.
Absolutely. And we take the, you know, in Ontario currently, as you were talking about single bottles being difficult, in Ontario, for the vast majority of people, unless you're spending over $500 a bottle, almost everything is going to be in cases of six.
Yeah.
And for almost everybody, if you're buying a $50 wine, a $300 six-pack or a $600 12-pack is a huge investment.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of the reason why people don't buy wine by the case in Ontario right now is quite frankly because a lot of agencies don't offer returns. And so you get stuck with a wine that you may have never tasted before, or you may have tasted at a dinner after having three or four other wines. And that can be quite a challenge. That's quite a challenge for me, quite frankly. And so the interesting part for me is where the market is going. I think the market is going to where eventually single bottle sales will be allowed. I don't think we're that far off. I think we're closer than most people think. But I think for the time being, the LCBO has yet to fully understand the market, and will always be at fault for that.
Yeah.
And they will, and it's literally money out of our pockets because our taxpayer dollars are invested in this place.
What is the, and you sort of hinted at the awareness level now versus back in the day when people, you know, I read an interview with Daniel Bick, with Aaron's brother, about how people didn't, and this was from an interview from 2009,
yeah,
saying people don't know they are legally allowed to buy wine online. There might be people listening now that are like, wait a minute, this is possible. But what's the awareness level now versus, you know, back in the day or when you started, you know, even before you started at Wine Online?
I think the awareness even today is still the vast majority of people don't know that they can buy wine outside of the LCBO. I think a lot of things are changing, and I think it's partially because wine has gotten so much more exciting. But I can certainly say that in the last 5 years, the awareness level in terms of what people are buying and where they're buying it from has grown a great deal. And our business has grown exponentially in the past 5 years. And I think that's a pretty good barometer as the major seller of wine online in Ontario, that there's clearly been a change and there's clearly people are starting to get interested. I think the other side of that argument, though, and the other thing that the LCBO would tell you about the consignment side, is that for a long time, agencies did not do a good job,
yeah,
of having stuff ready to go, of having a website at which you could be contact people, having an up-to-date sales list, having something as simple as a Shopify shop set up,
yeah,
on their website. And I think that even to this day, we're starting this year, I've seen a lot of good examples come out, but certainly not to the level that I think needs to be. I think the onus is on both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny. You said about you guys give, you know, you guys allow for refunds. Is one of the trickiest things that a couple, an individual, will try a wine and they'll love it. They're at the vineyard. They're on their honeymoon. They're having that bottle. Sun is setting. They're having truffled something or other. They buy the wine. They bring it home. It's Wednesday in February at 8:30 p.m. and they're having chicken. And then they open the wine and they're like, wait a minute. This doesn't taste like June in Tuscany. I think that's, is that like an issue that you guys ever had to deal with where, you know, the joy of wine sometimes is just as much psychological as it is about the work done by the winemaker or what the terroir was?
Oh, you couldn't be more right. It's not something we deal with a great deal. I'm always shocked when we look at our return numbers. Our return numbers are incredibly low,
mm-hmm,
much lower than I think any other retail industry might be.
Because you can also, you can give it away. You can take it to parties. You can serve it at parties. And the one thing, and sorry to interrupt, that I want to hear your answer there, is what I always tell people, because I'm a big fan of consignment. I buy from a lot of different companies. This wine here, we'll talk about Domaine Tempier, the 2011 Bandol. I got it from Barrel Select, and I used to work there for a brief period. And what I always would tell anyone in my brief time working there is, it's not milk. It's not going to go bad. And I know $600 might seem like a lot for that case, but you'll save money and gas and time if you buy a case of something you love versus going back to the LCBO 8 times and dealing with traffic. You know, it's something I always try to hammer home to people.
Absolutely. And you also get to have the experience of being able to watch a wine grow. And I want to go back to the experiential thing that you talked about, because
yeah,
I think wine is experiential. And I think it's really important to understand that and to experience it, because I think the greatest bottles of wine I've ever had were not the most expensive. They were not the most famous. They were, as you said, on a vineyard, literally within a vineyard, sitting down to pasta that's been made to me by the grandmother of the winemaker.
Yeah.
And opening an old wine, because I think great wine generally is has some age on it, and that experience, it elevates the wine a great deal. It's no different than a restaurant experience. It's no different than if you walk into a restaurant and the hostess is not very nice to you, it takes 20 minutes to get water. It doesn't matter how good the food is.
Yeah.
Once that happens, your experience is going to be 50%. And having worked in the restaurant business, I now take that experience to the wine business.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, just about. On the, it is so true at a restaurant, you know, the food can be delicious, the wine can be great, but there's just something that just sticks in you if the service is bad, and especially when it's not that the restaurant's understaffed. When you do, like, 'cause I, when I get, if I get slow service, the first thing I do is I will look around and I will count how many staff is here versus how many tables. And if it's like, oh, they're understaffed tonight, I'll give you a bit of a break. But when that's not the issue, then yeah, that the food doesn't seem to taste as good.
No, absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right. I think the thing about that is that it's not a lot different than wine, but I think at the end of the day, we live in a market where there are so many options for everything, wine, restaurants, everything else. So great customer service is pretty much the benchmark for any great business. And
100%.
Foundation.
So what do you think of the wine? And again, for people, Ben Dole, which is in southern France, it's a smaller appellation within Provence. It's a Mouvedre-based wine, which is a bit of a heavier, thicker-skinned. You know, this wine is just, I love this wine. Meaty notes, almost like a chocolate dust, not like a dark chocolate. I don't want to go soot, because that's sometimes when I say soot, that's like a Bordeaux that's gone bad. So I don't want to do that, but just a big, full-bodied, but still good acid on this wine. This is a dark fruit. So yeah, I love this producer. I love this wine.
I mean, 2011 is a cool year, and I love cool years in Provence. The wine to me is beautiful because of the tartness on the palate towards the end. I think you're absolutely right. It's absolutely dark fruit. There's absolutely some chocolate to it. There's no sense of oak either, which I really love. The oak is the oak is purely textural. It has nothing to do. And I'm pretty sure, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Tempier does not use any new oak.
No, I'm trying to remember because I was there like in 2014. I went to go visit. And yeah, when you go down below, it's a lot of giant older oak. It's the Botties. When I was there, I didn't see a lot of the new, just sort of, you know, new French barriques all running around all over the place.
Yeah, which tends to be the style now, which tends to be the what people are after these days.
It's always weird with oak. Like, it seems to go back and forth. Like, you know, like, say, Napa Cab. And in the 90s and the early 2000s, oak, oak, oak. And then everyone was like, you know, same thing like with grunge music came out of, before that, it was all hair bands.
Yeah.
And then from hair bands came grunge. It kind of feels like that, what we're seeing, where there's a movement towards less oak in so many, even in like Spain, like in so many parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in wine, I call it kind of a pendulum because I think it swings back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Something gets high marks, everyone tries to go there, and then they make those wines. But by the time those wines are released, you know, then it's like 3 years after the initial wave starts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the big thing about points, and there's a bunch of reasons why people are moving away from that. Granted, points still definitely sell wine.
Yep.
Selling wine online, I can tell you that points from reputable review sites are incredibly important. They really help.
Well, on your website, there's one of the categories is 90-point wines.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we know the market, and that's what the market wants, and we help people as much as they want. But if something that's $20 get 94 points, I guarantee you I'm going to sell 100 cases of it.
Yeah. It's like Toro.
Yeah.
You know, Carolyn Hammond wrote the great review on that wine in the Toronto Star, and this is not me saying anything good or bad about Carolyn or the wine, but it shows you that there is a level of insecurity when it comes to wine, because you want someone to confirm and then you'll go racing towards it.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not going to comment on that specific case because I don't think it's my place. But I will say that there has been a real push in the last couple of years from certain reviewers to rate very average wines very highly to get more publications to use them.
Yeah.
And that has pushed certain people. I can say one because it's in Australia, but James Halliday in Australia, I think. I mean, basically, if the wine is fermented, the wine gets 93 points from James Halliday. If it doesn't smell like a mouse, then it's a 94-point wine. And then up from there, I essentially think his scale, and you can go on his website and look. And he's been a very reputable distributor very reputable reviewer for a large number of years. So I've always been very confused by it. But he has gone to the scale that is literally 7 points.
Mm-hmm.
And what's funny about that is we're all talking about him. And he's getting a lot more brand distribution because of this. And so it's a business decision. And I come from the school of business. And so I can understand that. But wine is not that same thing. It's not eventually you burn out your brand.
Yeah, you do. And well, I mean, that is, there is such a delicate push and pull here between, you know, using numbers to try to help guide people, but at the same time, what are the motivations behind it? And it should never be about a business decision, and yet everyone has a mortgage to pay. Like, there is a real morality push and pull that goes on with ranking of wine.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think at the end of the day, points have clearly revolutionized it. And where I was going originally with this is, clearly there's a morality around it, but clearly there's also personal taste. Mm-hmm. So I think the most important thing for me to tell everybody is to tell everybody about a lot of the point scores are two things. First, almost all the point scores are based on barrel samples or on wines that have been bottled within 6 months. How a wine changes within 6 months to the, by the time that you actually taste it, generally 18 months after that, is substantial. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't reviewers out there that can taste a barrel and understand where it's going. There certainly are. But there's not a lot of surety in that. And you have to also understand that while they may know it's a good wine, they don't totally understand where the style of the wine is going. The second thing is that every reviewer is a person.
Yep.
You know, they're not robots. And oftentimes, they're tasting 400 wines in a day.
Yep.
And so if you're the front of that lineup, you're probably going to get a good score. But if you're the back of that lineup, by the time you've tasted 340 other wines, the last 60 are, you know, it tastes the same.
And you might be wanting to get through it and get it done. You might not give it the attention it deserves. Some days you might be in a really good mood as a reviewer, and then maybe, you know, the wines are going to get a slight bump because everything is good and right in the world. And then the other day you're about to get divorced, and now you've got to try 50 wines from Margaux for the futures tasting.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to what we're talking about really, really eloquently, actually. I think wine is experiential.
Yeah, right? It really
is. And so to not understand that occurs for reviewers as well as us, I also think that there's definitely biases among reviewers. I think in the end, though, we can kind of leave the reviewer thing here. I think you got to pick who you really like. And for me, my own palate, I really like Neil Martin. And I think he's one of the most honest reviewers and has been for about the past 15 years. If you want somebody to go and look at and say, you know what, I know what his palate is like. He's very consistent. And no matter how expensive the bottle is, no matter from what producer in Burgundy it is, if it's not a good wine, it gets 85 points. It gets 86 points. Whereas a lot of people don't generally, they rate based on prestige.
Yeah, like you don't want to be the reviewer. Thank you. Listeners can't see this, but the glass was getting dangerously low. And by the way, I appreciate, and it's one thing I always appreciate, the small pour. And we can get into that a bit, just restaurants when they give large pours when you buy the bottle. If you don't want to rip on a Grand Cru from Chambly Moussigny, if it, you know, you think it's an 87, you'll probably bump it up to a 90 because you don't want to be the person shit-talking that wine because you don't want to get shut out from that area.
Oh, that's just exactly it. You hit the nail on the head. The issue, if you don't, especially if you don't come from Venice or the Wine Advocate, is that as a small reviewer, if you rate wines poorly from a producer, there is a very good chance that you will not be allowed back.
Yeah.
And when you are trying to grow your job as a wine journalist, that's really important. I'm taking a small group of my friends and a couple of collectors to Burgundy, and I've forged relationships that have taken years to build. And I know that those people are not hard to get access to, and they're also judgmental of the way that their wines are portrayed in the public eye. Some of them are very good, others aren't, and I think that they don't see their wines that way.
Yeah,
and they're not particularly interested in inviting somebody over to their house and then having them, rightly or wrongly, say that this vintage was not very good.
And like, I can understand it, A, from an economic standpoint, others from just that wine, you know, even if it's bad, they put a lot of work in that wine. And sometimes it just doesn't work out. Like for this podcast, I'm not a journalist.
Yeah.
Unless it's like Apothic or something with 17 grams of sugar, you know, usually if there's wines I don't like, I just won't talk about it.
Yeah.
Like I've had a couple times where wineries will send me stuff, will send me product. And if I like the wine, I will talk about it.
Yeah.
And I know that might seem goody-two-shoes. If I don't like the wine, I'm just not going to talk about it you know, because I have a different job than if I'm working for Wine Enthusiast or Absolutely. Wine Spectator or something like that. So you and Neil Martin, like, I always, you know, I trust Jancis. You know, I don't know if, like, I generally tend to trust a little more Decanter. But I think the important lesson is, and you said, I thought you said it well, is that if everyone is going to start looking at the reviews, two things. One, calibrate yourself, find yourself writers that, you know, you sort of fall in line with. And also, take a look at who's giving the review, because every city has 400 wine county fairs. So just because they won a gold medal, not every gold medal is the same color.
Oh, I could not agree with that more. And the other thing is that the wine world is not black and white, right?
No.
I've become aware in the last 2 years of large-scale wineries creating their own review sites.
Oh, no.
Through intermediary companies and then building right. them up, not reviewing their own wines for the first year, but in the second year, reviewing their own wines.
Really?
Yeah. And I won't give any names, but it will come out in the next year, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and there's other things too, right? Like, you got to understand, like, this world is not impartial. The wine reviewer for Robert Parker 10 years ago in Spain was banned from ever reviewing anything again because he was found to be taking money.
Really?
From the Consejo Regulador, so the from the region.
Yep.
To visit who he was going to visit. And that's not an uncommon story. I think it's the only time that I've ever heard of somebody actually getting caught doing it. But you have a lot of other people. Another great example, Luca Moroni, somebody who was a massive distributor in Italy on his own, also reviews all the wines that he distributes, reviews them very highly. You know, there's a lot of stuff where you look at it and you go, all right, this doesn't, it's 96 points, but it's 96 points from the guy that's trying to sell it to me.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Do your research is the theme. Speaking of Spanish wine, I was reading Good Food Revolution, the interview with Sam Jeremy Ennis. Quote, Sam Fritz Tate knows more about Spanish wine than any human being should ever know. I was wondering if you wanted to comment on that quote from that interview.
Yeah, absolutely. So Spain has always been my specialty. I mean, I could say now that I drink a lot more French, but Spain has always been my specialty. I lived in Spain with a family that was involved in banking. I did something called the Rotary International Youth Exchange, where people in the Rotary clubs exchange kids. And I was very lucky to live with the VP of CaixaBank, and he was invested in a couple of wineries, and that's kind of where I found my love for wine. But when I started working in wine here, I was a waiter in fact, I started as a dish polisher at Patria mm-hmm. on King Street.
Great, fantastic place for Spanish wine.
Phenomenal.
They're like, they switch it up when they've got their heater going, like on their by the glass program.
Yeah.
Like sometimes, okay, it's good, and there's other times you look at it like, damn, that is a good list.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I ran the list there for a number of years, and I can say that I definitely built the largest library. I'm not sure it's still intact now. It's a very busy restaurant, but
yeah.
We were really lucky to have a really great ownership team that was willing to allow us to invest, and we built a library of wines that I think truly shows you the greatest part of Spain. I think the amazing thing about Spain is diversity. And Spain is such a diverse country, and for a long time it was all Tempranillo, it was all over-oaked, it didn't live very long, but there's two time frames and two groups of wines I love in Spain. One is the very old Riojas. I'm talking Rioja from the period of 1973 back to the 30s. There was a time period in Rioja where they truly made some of, if not the greatest wines of the world outside of France at the time. They made wines that were so ethereal, so light, they left them in these large barrels for 20, 30, 40 years in barrels. Before they bottled them, they would then let them sit in bottle for another 10 years.
That is the most economic worst decision you could make.
And it's why a lot of the wineries are now bankrupt. And I've made it my job to conserve a lot of this history through buying cellars, whether they're from restaurants, whether they're from defunct wineries in Spain, and holding them, because I think that they're truly some of the greatest wines ever made, especially for the white wines made from Viura with a mix of Malvasia and Garnacha Blanca. You have wines that even today, and I can show you one after this, wines from the 30s and the 20s that are as white as California Chardonnay from 2 years ago. It's really...
Really?
And it has a lot of it has to do with storage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For sure,
yeah.
In terms of impeccable, they literally were put in a bunker somewhere and they never moved. But
yeah.
And then New Spain. New Spain's super exciting because New Spain focuses on underdeveloped wine regions that are all about exciting, incredibly unique terroir, whether we're talking about the Canary Islands, where you have this incredible país or Listón Negro, as they say, being grown on volcanic soil and a place where it can snow, where you can ski and surf on the same day, where you get this amazing mix of African influence, of Southern Spanish influence, or whether it's Northern Spain in Ribera Sacra, where they make some of the most electric, alive, intellectual wines today, made based on Mencia, old Mencia mixed with other white and red varietals. I think there's just so much of Spain to love right now in a very fresh, unique, exciting way that it truly makes it some of the most compelling wine. It definitely is the best value country in the world. And I think at the top end now, like from places like Grados Grenache, makes some of the most exciting wines for collectors as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, as we've talked before, and I've done a couple podcasts on it when I was in Rueda. I had a guy's weekend at my cottage a little while ago for a fantasy football weekend. So I guess by the time this comes out, it'll be about a month and a half since then. And on the Sunday, you know, we're staying up for one more night, the winning white bottle was, you know, about four years on it at Rueda. Just this, you know, this old, like 80-year-old vine, Verdejo. It might have seen a little bit of oak. I don't think a lot. And we were just, you know, in first sip, you like the complexity, the power, the acid, like all there. Not a combination you usually expect of that much acid and still power on it. So that was like a winning wine. And speaking of the night, getting back to an earlier thing about how the best bottle isn't always the most expensive.
Yeah.
Best bottle that entire weekend and open up some good stuff was a Village level Chambertin, and had 2014. And I had it with my two friends while we were sitting on the end of a boat.
Yeah.
And watching the sunset, and it was killer. Like, it was just so alive and doing so many different things, and so you're both confused and enjoying every moment of it. So that's one of the best bottles I've had this year, and it was a Village level Chambertin.
I think that the misnomer with Burgundy is that there's no value left anymore. I think that granted, it's totally experiential, but I think like that is such a great story for people to hear. Like, granted, we're doing a dinner tonight with Grand Cru Burgundy, and it's all going to be very old. But I think that there's so many. I think one of the greatest pieces of advice I can give to any wine buyer is don't buy mid-tier or low-level producers' top wines. Buy the top producers' cheapest wine. So when it comes to Burgundy, what I'm saying is don't buy Premier Cru from Jadot that's $100.
Yep.
Buy $60 Bourgogne. Mm-hmm. From Lafarge, from Trappe, from any of the great estates of Burgundy, and you'll be so much more pleased because you get the same care, the same attention to detail in a wine that is going to be much easier to drink much earlier.
Yeah, it's a great point. And it's funny, on one of my last podcasts, going back to Spain, I don't know why, every now and then I'll just randomly go to the LCBO and just buy a bottle of something I haven't had in a while.
Yeah.
So it was Ribera del Douro, the Balbus 2006 Reserva, $23.95. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to grab this.
Yeah.
And just open it, let it sit for like an hour, and fully recommend. Like, just, again, dark fruit, plummy, and there's like 10% cab that's blended into it. It smelled hot, but the alcohol didn't go down. It wasn't like an overwhelming, and, you know, some smoky, some chocolate. And the thing I recommend this wine for, and the only negative is you got to like America, or you, not American, you got to like oak influence. This one certainly had it.
Yeah.
But it was a wine where I said, if you liked Napa Cab, but you want to sort of stray, give this a shot. Yeah. It's not going to cost you a ton. It's not cheap. It's not going to cost you a ton, but it's big. There's a lot of power, but you get dried fruit, balsamic notes. You know, you get more than what you might get for a Napa Cab that's $35-40. So that was like one recommendation that I threw out a little while ago.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think the best way to define Ribera del Douro is new world fruit with old world freshness.
Yeah.
Or old world structure. And I think that you described it pretty well. It's like, for people that love Napa Cab, Ribera del Douro is going to be one third to one tenth of the price.
Yeah.
And is always going to deliver at a high level for those people. And I think that that extra degree of freshness is going to make it so much more enjoyable for them, especially with food. No matter how charbroiled your ribeye is, Caymus Special Select is still not the right wine.
For yeah.
Like, it's just sugar does not do good things for your palate.
Are you saying that Caymus might have a little more residual sugar than you like?
I would not. I will neither confirm nor deny that.
So I did a little digging around in your Instagram account. A 1990 Charme Chambertin, an 88 Cornas, a 60 Vega Sicilia. I was wondering if you want to talk any of those or any other memorable older wines that you've drank, just for a lot of listeners that maybe haven't tried wines that are 25, 30 plus years old, just some of the experiences you get.
For sure. I mean, I've made it my business to drink old wine, and I've spent...
By the way, that's a great business. Like, some people, what's your business? Well, you know when there's a dead raccoon on the Highway 400? My business is making sure it's eliminated, you know? And by the way, an important business and something that is needed in our society. Yours is drinking old wine. That's a very, very smart, Sam.
I think, yeah, I mean, it totally is. I definitely chase what I like.
Yeah.
I think that when you catch a wine that's 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 100 years old, that still captures freshness and a sense of place, to me, wine is kind of like art or like a picture even. The clearer it is, the better it is. And so I absolutely love old wine, and I collect a great deal of it. In terms of experiences, I'll give you two or three, and you can cut me off at any point, but... Maybe the greatest wine I've ever had, definitely the best old wine I've ever had. I had a bottle of 1888 or 1887 Chateau Yquem. That was definitely otherworldly just because it was so fresh and so alive.
That's
nuts.
You wonder why those wines are that expensive. Say, hey, because some years they don't even make the wine if the vintage isn't good enough. So they're pissing away a lot of assets. That's nuts that it was still that fresh, that old.
Yeah, besides Chenin Blanc from the Loire Valley, there's no other dessert wine that lasts as long as those. I mean, Bordeaux. The thing about Bordeaux is it's incredibly expensive. And granted, I think after 89, you can basically say that the wine's changed a great deal. But I've had enough bottles from the 60s and 50s to know that those are truly some of the greatest wines in the world, and maybe they seem very expensive to a lot of people, and they certainly are. But I don't think they're—I don't think they're more expensive than they should be. The other one I'll touch on, two sweet wines. You can kind of tell that I like sweet white wine. Is I just had two nights ago a bottle of 1948 Domaine Huet Demi Sec, so semi sweet Vouvray. Mm-hmm. So Chenin Blanc from the Loire Valley.
Yep.
We opened it, and it was mind-blowing. Clearly the color showed development, and clearly the nose had a little bit of development in terms of spices that were clearly exotic, but there was still honeysuckle, there was still fresh fruit. I think of Chenin Blanc as like the indestructible grape. I've never had a bottle of Domaine Huet, and I've gone far older than that didn't feel like it could go another 50.
Yeah. And by the way, for anyone googling Huet, find it, drink it, you'll love it. Yeah, the Domaine Huet is pretty nuts.
I think the other one that really sticks out for me is, I'll say the producer, I can say the vintages, but is Jean-Louis Chauve.
Yeah.
And this is kind of, I think a lot of sommeliers are going to give you this. I don't always conform, but Jean-Louis Chauve's wines, when they're old, and I've had 83, 85, 89, 90, 95, 97, I've had in the 79, I don't think I've ever had a bad bottle. And they speak to you in a way, they are so utterly complex, so utterly perplexing, yet so enthralling at the same time. They change in the glass every time you smell them. And to me, I talked a little bit earlier about, you know, maybe Pinot Noir is the greatest grape in the world. I think Syrah definitely ends up being it. And I think the reason why is that Syrah is always going to have that extra bit of earthy, meaty, bacony complexity that Pinot very rarely gets, and when it does, I don't think it really shows the greatness of the grape.
And that's sometimes not what you want from it. I mean, maybe from some sort of Pommard or something like that, you're going to get it, but you know, you or Chambertin maybe, yeah. But yeah, you know, like that's not really what I want. My in uh, some of that my Pinot. And yeah, you're, I mean, the funny thing is one of the first people I did the interview with in this pod was Emily Pierce. And yeah, for her, same thing. It's probably a Northern Rhone Syrah. If she had to pick one, it would probably be that.
Yeah. I don't think... I hope everybody gets the experience of the wines. Thing about wines in the Rhone Valley is that they are made in minuscule quantities, but I hope that if you ever get a chance to buy a bottle from 95 or before, that you take the chance and do it, because from great producers, Domaine Jamais, Chauve, Jabulet pre-1990 or 90 and before.
I got a 90 of the Jabulet.
La Chapelle?
Yeah.
Yeah. Those wines are, and granted, I can tell you that since 1995, for sure, when the old man died, those wines are not worth a quarter of the money that they, or certainly half the money that they're now charging for them. But those old wines are unbelievable in terms of what they deliver. But you can go down the list. The great thing about the Northern Rhone is there's so many great producers. You go to Cornas, a region that I love, Noël Versailles, Clap, Auguste Clap, people that Thierry Alamand. I mean, these people were true farmers who made almost no money, and they made wine in a very dirty way. There was certainly not a lot of hygiene used, but they made wine the way their ancestors did, and it turned out these wines that today we speak of as the greatest wines of the world. And I think that shows you this move to technology, while important, is not the be-all, end-all.
And for people, Cornas is in Northern Rhone, small appellation. It is 100% Syrah, Syrah-only region. On the website, I'm curious about how on the wineonline.ca website, you say, we recognize the quality of wine being made in our own backyard. As such, we make regular visits to our local wineries and make the standouts available to our customers. How hard is it to sell Canadian wine to Canadians?
Incredibly.
Isn't that just annoying? There's such good wine here.
It's brutal. especially for Chardonnay, for Pinot. There's some incredible, Gamay is really incredible, and I mean, I think the red standout has to be Cabernet Franc. But
it's funny, I would have given the exact same list.
Yeah,
Gamay, Pinot, Cab Franc, and Chardonnay are just...
Riesling's really good too. I don't think there are that many great producers for it. I think there's a lot of very good producers for it.
Yeah, Featherstone, not expensive, solid. It's not going to blow you away, but it's always going to be enjoyable.
Yeah, and I think price point wise, like, I mean, there's just so many great $25, $30 wines. I just did a Niagara trip, and I do them quite regularly, and I tasted at Leaning Post for the first time. And Ilya the Centric, the winemaker, is someone I think in the next 5 years is going to be making some of, if not Ontario's, greatest wines. He's very close to Niagara, so he's pretty far away from the rest of the wine growing region. He's making Pinot Chard and a little bit of Syrah. His 16th Centric Chardonnay, he got a very good award from it. I bought as many Magnums as he would sell me that day, because I tasted it and I said, I've never seen this kind of level of freshness with the lack of oak and the winemaking. The degree of winemaking skill I thought was just phenomenal.
Yeah. What's the, for you guys, for the website, what's the hottest selling wine right now?
Spain.
Yeah.
Spain. Value. It doesn't shock me. Mm-hmm. You know, what you get from Spain for $15 to $20 will cost you 30 in France.
Yeah.
Maybe 40. Maybe it costs you 30 in Italy. Granted, we have a lot of my specialty is in Spain, so I'm definitely on the heartbeat of the next good thing coming up. But I don't think that there's any other country where you can get a $15 bottle of wine that absolutely rocks right now.
And has some age on it.
And can go longer.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's so many wines from Northern Spain, from Rioja, from Catalonia, that, you know, they're 5 years old, 6 years old when you buy them. They're $15. And for you to put that down in your cellar for another 5 years, no problem. I'll give one example, and I won't plug too many of our wines, but I will plug one that's just about to come back, is Valsotillo. Valsotillo is one of the original five producers of Ribera del Duero. They make some incredibly expensive wines, and Ismael, the founder and winemaker, and his family have been producing wines there for about 300 years. So
They've been doing it for a while.
They produce a wine called Funca Benavista, which is $24.95 tax in per bottle. And we can't keep it in stock just because it is such great value. When you're talking about great things for people that like Napa cabs. It has all that extra depth of complexity. It has that extra kick, and it has this level of freshness that you go, wow, like this is a big wine. It's not a light wine, but man, does it deliver in terms of complexity. And I have a bottle of 2009 in my cellar that I opened for my girlfriend and her parents the other day. And it was just, I can't imagine another $25 bottle that would have been that good.
We're getting to an end, so maybe a couple of rapid fire. I would ask, what are you drinking right now? But I imagine it's a lot of Spanish wine. Wine trends that you find interesting, wine trends that annoy you.
Wine trends that I find interesting. I'll go with the annoying one.
Everyone wanted the annoying one. I did the interesting one just to make it positive. But
natural wine.
What's that?
Natural wine.
Yeah.
I think it's a really North American thing to want to classify wine as natural or classic, or because I think the greatest wines of the world, we can talk about Northern Rhone Syrah as a great example. Those wines were made without almost any sulfites, without almost any I think the issue for me is not that there aren't great natural wines. There certainly are. The three key things for me are, one, variability. So wine made without sulfur. Sulfur, for those people that don't know, is a preservative. It's injected in a wine not to make it. It's essentially made to put in there to last longer.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing about SO2 is that it's in the air. If you eat blueberries, a cup of blueberries, you're going to eat more than you will ever drink this year.
Yeah.
Unless you're drinking like eight bottles of wine a day, personally, right? So the question
it's
for
a tough
me,
day.
Yeah,
a
exactly, tough day. Exactly. So the question for me is this: is why do we have to define wine as being one thing or the other? I think.
Yeah. DRC Aubert Verlaine uses sulfur.
Absolutely.
So if they are, it's not the end of the world.
No, I just hope that people won't taste what's in the glass, and I think that I would just hope that we can come back to a place where it's about what's in the glass and not but what the winemaker says about it.
Yeah.
Granted, I think that biodynamic wines are generally going to show better than wines that aren't. Granted, I think that natural wines are incredibly fresh generally, and there are some great examples of people that are big natural wine pushers that are great producers. Ganavat, an incredible producer from the Jura that is just making stupendous wines. But the most important thing about those producers is that they have a sense of place, which is incredibly important, and it's something that we could touch on with orange wine, and that they're stable. And stable means that when I buy a case of 12, I get a consistent example.
Yeah.
But I think, like, to go back to the sense of place in orange wine, the other thing that really frustrates me about this is, like, we love this, like, orange peel, orange tannin thing that comes from these orange wines. The only thing that separates them from another great wine is the fact that they all taste the same at some point. Volatile acidity, once you get too much of it in the bottle, is going to make everything taste a little bit like vinegar.
Yep.
And I hope that we get people interested enough in drinking wines that have a sense of place, a sense of uniqueness, and something that they truly love. And I don't think that natural wine hits that nail on the head very often.
Yeah, I've been getting shit for this. I'm not a fan of orange wine. I'm sorry. I'm not. And listen, I've recommended to everyone Southbrook's Bordeaux blends. Their Chardonnay is one of my favorite. What I love about Southbrook, they've got library. They keep a library of their Chardonnays. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
I appreciate the work that goes into their orange wine, and I think they might be one of the best examples of orange wine in Ontario.
Yeah.
And even I'm like, okay, you're fine, but I'd rather have a glass of your Chardonnay than a glass of your orange wine. And I'm using them as an example as one of the best.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the cool thing, the one thing I will say, the saving grace to natural wine is it's gotten a lot of people from the younger generation involved in wine.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think that no matter what you do, if you continue to taste wine and continue to have an open mind, you're going to end up having your own flavor. And I'm not looking down on anybody that likes natural wine.
No.
And I think it's more of, I love that you love those wines, but I hope that you don't buy them just because they're natural.
Yes.
I hope that you buy them because you love them.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's kind of what I'm trying to push. And I think, like, you know, if you really love really faulted natural wine that smells like dead mice, like, more power to you. Like, that's awesome. Like, somebody's got to sell that wine.
Someone's got to drink it, yeah.
You're supporting a farmer somewhere, and I think that's awesome. I think we all need to have a little bit more indifference of what other people like and be more concerned with what we like.
And last question for you. Just really tell people, I mean, A, I want you to promote wineonline.ca, but also any like tips, people that want to dip their toe, want to get into buying wine through consignment. And, you know, I've interviewed a bunch of consignment people. I will always endorse and support this industry. I worked in it briefly, friends in this business, obviously, but for people, for listeners who have never bought wine via the internet, you know, why should they do it?
They should do it because we offer wines that you'll never see on LCBO shelves, and quite frankly are not on LCBO shelves because they are so great that we don't want to produce. I think most truly great wines, and with few exceptions, are really small, small lot wines. They're made not in enormous quantities. I think the other reason to buy online is because of our customer service. And maybe it's not Wine Online specifically, but there are a number of good agencies that work with us. I will plug our own agency, though.
Only
because we work with a lot of our other agencies. What most people don't understand is that maybe 80% of the wines that we sell are our wines, but we work with all of the best wine agents in Ontario. And the reason why is because we have to do 708 offers a year. And to do that and keep our producers happy and not just, you know, have one offer a year from each producer and have 708 different suppliers, we need to work with other agents. And so we've built relationships, and I'll name a few, being Halpern Small Winemakers, Nicholas Pierce, to name a few, that are truly professional, great agencies that will give you such great customer service, have such unique, diverse, and interesting portfolios. And you'll get to experience wine a different way. And I think that that's what we're trying to push, is that we're trying to push something that's experiential, that gets people really jived about drinking wine and enjoying it.
Sam, really appreciate this. The website's great. It's easy to use. And it's a great place for people who want to dip their toe into the wine consignment world. Sam, thanks so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. Have an excellent day.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Audio Boom, and you can find me, rate, review, and remember, you can find this and all my podcasts wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.